Accession number 30143, Reel 11.
Matthew Cook, Reel 11.
And it was quite different now being responsible for people, which was a rather scary thing, from being an illustrator to suddenly being responsible for people's lives. And it dawned on me how lucky I was driving around of my own free will. Suddenly here I'm always tasked, I've always got other people, I'm escorting people, so I can't just go over. I had these images that, right, I'll go and see Hamid and I'll see his family. I never got the chance. That whole bit of Basra was out of bounds to British troops, so that's quite a different world coming back there. But I would we obviously went to the palace quite a lot, so it was strange seeing how that had been barricaded. The building where the Royal Horse Artillery were, where I'd slept, was now the sort of interim Iraqi authority, so it's like the local government building. So that was fascinating. No, I just had to go and poke my head round just to see. They'd brought in furniture and put in windows and air conditioning, so the place had been reworked. The Basra had changed a bit. They're actually beginning to sweep up the streets, and guys in yellow uniforms are cleaning the streets, and some of the rubbish is being cleaned up. So loads more traffic. That was the first thing I noticed, and people out in the streets. But yes, I realised how lucky I was to be able to drive anywhere. This time, you know, going past locations, there's one spot. For almost the whole tour, 6 months, I was itching to draw there. It was Basra Station, railway station. And again, there was more blown up. There were tanks, old Russian tanks on the back of flatbed trucks. Every time I went past, itching to draw, but it was just never the opportunity. I couldn't stop. So after, I think in about the fifth month of being there, that we were coming back from an escort duty from the palace, and I took a diversion down there. I said, right, lads, put out security, and a couple of my guys came with me, and I just took some photos for 20 minutes. But that was frustrating as hell if I hadn't have been able to stop. There's lots of things I missed. But on the upside, part of our job was to guard the JHF, which is the Joint Helicopter Force. Joint Force, I only ever saw British helicopters, but it sounds very grand, but there was only about two Chinooks and two Pumas and two Lynx helicopters.
I bet they were important.
They were used constantly. The Lynx helicopters could never take off in the heat, so they just stayed on the tarmac the entire time I was there. I never saw them take off. But thankfully, I was literally a guard commander at the helicopter base, and I got to know the wing commander who was in command of the helicopter force. And I did some drawings of some of his helicopters and managed to get someone to get some colour photocopies and pop them under his door. We became sort of quite good friends, as you can, you know, between the RAF and the army. I'd still call him sir, but it was a bit more relaxed. And he'd call me maestro, and he'd come down, right, now what can we do for you? And I'd always say, what flights can I get on? So we had a sort of 9-day rotation where we'd do 3 days guard, 3 day picking up fuel and building materials from Kuwait, and then 3 days escort duties to the palace or up into wherever it was, all the sort of Basra area. And occasionally in that chunk, you'd have days where nothing was happening. So I would get it okay with my sort of commanders, but I'd jump on helicopters to wherever I could. Went to central Iraq and all over the place. Quite often the helicopters would get small arms fire. I'd be sort of literally leaning out the window with my helmet and goggles, and all the flares would pop off, which meant someone's firing. Obviously you can't hear in a helicopter, so it's only once you landed we'd all look around the helicopter looking for any damage. But yeah, I had some great adventures. Went to Nazaria. I should have done. Reminded me before we left.
Interesting looking from above, I would think.
It was.
Is it?
Yes, Nazaria I went back to again. Yes, quite different. Mostly the flights were done at sort of 100 metre height, just above pylons. In fact, they'd have to fly up to get over the pylons. because you're a harder target and can't be heard coming if you're that low. But occasionally, there was a few sabotage attacks on the oil pipelines that had set huge oil fires burning. And we'd, depending on what flight, there were all sorts of different tasks. So some were just taking aerial photographs of the damage, in which case we'd go up to a few thousand feet. And you'd see how the rivers would run through. Everything would be lush green, and then it's just desert beyond that. It was fascinating. Yeah, it gave me quite a different angle on it. And
did you do painting?
I did loads. I did loads. Yes. Yes. And thankfully, I invited the wing commander to my exhibitions in 2005, sort of a year after that. And he bought one of the drawings I did of him. In fact, he was flying one of the Pumas on one of the flights. So yeah, it was nice. It was nice. He was very good to me. I can't remember. Endless flights I went on. I can't even. Coming back to me, so some of them were Eagle VCPs, which are helicopter-borne vehicle checkpoints. So the troops would emplane onto a Chinook and then just be dropped on a road to make a sudden vehicle checkpoint, which is another Northern Ireland trick. So it's not a static point, just suddenly it's a surprise. Just obviously just trying to catch some of these munitions that are being shipped around. A great adventure. And as long as I can photocopy the drawings, the flight crew are always interested. Unfortunately, they rotated in 2-month tours, so just as I got to know some of the pilots, they'd all change. And so some would be sort of wary or it'd be hard to get on board, and others are, oh yeah, we know who you are, come on board. So I'd always go with my rifle, a day set, water, some rations, and we'd just go off to wherever. Like one time we got stuck in Nazaria because there's quite a big gun battle in town. Just a big adventure.
So probably very different, these sites you were recording, from your first visit.
Yes, it was. It didn't. I can't. The two are the same, just because a lot of the locations. But every experience was so different. You know, all my time in Baghdad was just in the green zone, which I hadn't seen before. So it's, to me, it's a completely different experience. Yes, unfortunately, we were meant to be blistering onto some American patrols in Baghdad, but because of the Sadr uprising, just nothing was happening. The Americans weren't going out, so a bit of a mixed blessing. But it meant I could get some drawings, actually, in this huge complex. It's the green zone is, I don't know, some 8 square kilometres. I think somewhere I actually worked it out. It's a huge area. And I think we went into the Republican Guard headquarters, and I found this German-made, it had obviously been hit by a JDAM bomb, one of those bombs that's supposed to go through all the floors and then explode. We went up to the roof, and there's this huge domed roof to it, and slap bang in the middle of the roof was this hole, sort of half a metre wide, where the JDAM had come through, right in the middle of the dome. But I think the Germans had built the building, so it had all this, the dome was all sort of fake, it was just conference rooms and things. But then there was a sort of 20 metre concrete reinforced steel roof to it, and then the sort of business offices, and the JDAM hadn't even damaged that, so it was very clever, very clever. And then below that we found another German built nuclear bunker that went on, it was flat full of respirators, plastic body bags for a chemical attack. Each door you went to had a shower and hose thing for decontamination. So really, obviously worried about the, I think it was built in the 80s, so obviously worried about the Iran Iranian chemical threat. Quite fascinating. Yeah, the difference with this was there was no chemical threat, so I didn't have to carry a respirator, although it was often in the bottom of my day sack. But that was quite a relief, I remember. Going back to the first trip, I do remember finding Iraqi, or German-made, again, Iraqi respirators in a lot of the gun positions, so they obviously were there, and they obviously expected some chemical threat either by us or them, I have no idea. So it's, although no weapons are found, it was obviously on someone's mind. I visited lots of the same locations, some of the You know, I went back to the Ba'ath Party headquarters, and that was the one with all the unexploded bombs in. That still had the unexploded bombs in. It was quite a shock, changing from obviously illustrator's life to suddenly, you know, waking up at 5 a.m. and getting my ammunition, my smoke grenade, my morphine, checking the rounds, grenades for the grenade launcher. It just became a different routine. And in hindsight, it was actually very simple. The night before, from platoon commander, we get our tasks, where to go. I'd spend that evening mulling over my maps, working out routes, issuing ammunition, who goes where. There's quite a lot of paperwork, booking out, booking in, who's on the vehicles, their blood groups, and it just became a sort of routine. You do that day's jobs, and in the evening you get a new task. So there was no thinking.
Yeah. Very different from this freedom you had.
Yes, and I was very aware of it.
Off in your,
but the helicopters, in a way, created that freedom. But and conversely, there's no time alone. We're certainly in the tents. There's 10 of us in one tent, sometimes 8. So literally have a couple of square metres is your patch. There's no time alone, which can drive you mad after a while. So yeah, it's quite nice to get on the helicopter flights and just meet new people and just switch off a bit. Yeah, it was a fascinating experience, and coming back from that I found it far harder to readjust to life. I know it's a longer time, but maybe also the different lifestyle made it harder.
While you were there, had the suicide attack started?
Yes. We were there in Basra when there were so many... Yes, as I said, the Sabra uprising started, so the airfield started getting rocket attacks, which you could actually hear whistling in. It was a bit alarming, but it became so every day that I'd actually sleep through them. People going, oh, you know, where were you when last night's mortar attack? I was asleep, and so, but they never injured anyone. Obviously, an airfield is such a flat, spread-out area that thankfully nothing hit accommodation. It's changed recently. I noticed someone was killed recently in Basra by a mortar bomb. And the way they did it was quite crude. They'd often use wooden crates, you know, pallets left against the sand berm, and they'd put the rockets placed there or tied there. And they'd have a car battery with a timer. So that they were only very crudely aiming it, and right in the middle of the Basra air station is the control tower with a big red light. I remember when we first flew in, the plane's lights are off, we've all got our helmets and body armour on, there's very few lights about, but the control tower has a bright red light on, and I'm thinking, isn't that, why black everything else out but have that? And so halfway through our tour they realised that all these rockets were always lined up in the bright red light of the control tower. I've lost the track of it. More about the attacks. Lots of close scrapes. We'd often be driving along and you'd hear bursts of gunfire. Thankfully we've never got any hits, but you just have to assume that that was towards you or at you. We'd quite often go past other call signs who had been ambushed minutes before, so you realised how random it was. If it was just your turn, that was you.
You were saying in the beginning, you know, you had some sort of relationship with the local people. The fact that all this was going on, did it make you now treat everyone with suspicion?
It was a bit of that. We'd still get the kids going, hello mister, and well done, down with Saddam. So they were still doing that. Yeah. No, I wouldn't trust them. As soon as you passed, they'd have their catapults out and be firing stones at you. So it's... And certainly seeing the police doing the cutthroat, and this was at the time when there were sort of kidnaps and beheadings, and it was all going really nasty. So, you're in a feeling for revenge and... No payback, but obviously it's not going to happen. No, we did have very strict rules of engagement. In fact, that was quite a lot of our training. One of the sort of weirdest ones, or to explain to civilians, is if someone's coming after you with a hand grenade and they're about to throw a hand grenade, you can shoot them while it's in their hand, but as soon as it's left their hand, they're not the threat, it's the hand grenade. So if you shot them after they've thrown the hand grenade, you could be done for manslaughter, which all seems mad. And if they turn around and are running away, which fairly more obviously that would be manslaughter. So there's very fine lines, so you're very reluctant to fire. But yes, it's quite a responsibility. You've almost got this authority to kill for a situation. It's quite a lot to take on board in hindsight. And you've that fear of getting it right. If you shot and got someone got it wrong and they were throwing a tomato or a rock and it wasn't a hand grenade, they're quite scary.
And had all the, I think you mentioned earlier, the news about the what had happened, you know, the bad behaviour, examples of bad behaviour to certain Iraqis.
Yes,
by
I think
the British and, you know.
Yes, I think the Abu Ghraib was coming out as well.
Yeah.
And there's obviously a propaganda network because in Iraq, or Basra, they had printed out coloured posters of those, you know, whatever the iconic figure, hooded figure, sort of electrodes on him. And those are plastered on every lamppost. So, reverberations are very quick. And from then on, we'd get rocks and smash windscreens on the rovers. And yes, we turned quite hostile. When we initially were there, I think we had a sort of roadside bomb maybe once or twice a month. And by the time we left, it was almost every day. So it completely changed.
That was in 7 months.
Yes,
six months
out there.
Six months.
Yeah, we had 2 months training.
Yes. And was there also fear of kidnappings at this time?
Yes. Again, with our intelligence, we heard that there was a price on every coalition forces soldier's head. I think it was $600 at the time, but for a woman, it was $1,000. And obviously, there's quite a few sort of female soldiers, drivers, and logistics. There was a price, and we heard that there was a price. They're offering quite good wages for people to fight on the insurgents' side. Again, I think it's like several, almost like $500 a day. It's better wages than we were on. So we all jokingly volunteered, but it got alarming. It did escalate quite a lot.
Did you have women in your group? Were you responsible for women?
Only occasionally. We had some company clerks and various people, and I would occasionally offer them to take them out on some of the patrols. They can be top cover in the back of the rover. The Americans would go around in these Humvees with mounted turrets. All we had was stripped down Land Rovers with someone in the back with a machine gun. That was our cover. So there's no protection from rounds or a bomb blast or anything. I think just after our tour, then it changed to getting the snatch vehicles, which have a sort of Kevlar side to them that stops shrapnel. And now they've got sort of more updated vehicles, so we were, again, at just that period. So, yeah, a lot of people injured from those. Yes, we did. So occasional girls, and we would get occasional journalists out, which is ironic, me escorting journalists around, so that's quite funny. And another, basically, to get my drawings, I'd sort of jumped on every opportunity to get out and about in town, and I got to know the media ops people who basically escort the media around, and they were very down on manpower. So on any days off that I had, again, days off doesn't sound right, but any days when I wasn't tasked, I could go and be top cover for them, and we'd go to some location. We'd go off to Nazaria or someplace in Badger. So I just took every top opportunity to get out into town and just get off Basra Air Station, which was got quite dull after. Even after a few days it got dull, so it was good to escape. Yeah, we went to Chemical Ali's house and all sorts of interesting things.
Yes, were you there? I suppose he was caught a long time ago.
Yes, it was a long time ago, and there wasn't much left of his house. That was pretty
really?
Clean, but his swimming pool was full of bullet holes, and obviously emptied, but the rumour was that he shot people in the swimming pool. Well, who knows? Made good stories to the press.
And would this have been when Saddam was caught? After, would you have been there?
I'm not sure of the timeline. I think he was caught just before we deployed. It might have been December.
Yeah,
literally a week before we went.
It was December 03, wasn't it? Yes, it was. Mm.
And I think some of us were either a bit disappointed, like, oh, would it all fizzle out now? Or weren't quite sure what would happen.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Were you disappointed when he was caught?
I think a lot of the lads, you want to get into some sort of gun battle, but I think it wasn't until we had guys injured that people began to change their mind.
It's probably rather like the first Gulf War, when it stopped before a lot of people had got in it, hadn't it? You know, with the Bush Senior stopped the fight.
Yes, this felt like
I mean,
finishing off unfinished business.
Yes.
Yes, I'm still not sure about the rights or wrongs of the war. I'm still sort of undecided on that. I'm proud to have done my bit. But
are you? Yes.
Yeah, a bit disappointed that no one else really thinks. Well, I think generally the public's behind the troops, but the rest of the politics,
I mean. I was going to ask you, knowing how the country felt about the war, this massive mood against it, did it make a difference to the fighting people, to you as a...
It did. What hit us most, again, were those Daily Mail photographs. Because I remember someone brought the paper round, and we were looking at it, and we're going, he hasn't got a sling on his rifle, all the ammunition pouches are open, that's not real. But the newspaper hadn't clocked that, and it just didn't look right. The Bedfords, I'd never seen a Bedford truck out there, so nothing figured in it, it just didn't look real. And sure enough, they weren't real, but the damage was done. You know, whatever you said, you know, the police were already going, you know, doing shooting signs at us. And so,
well, I suppose they weren't real, but those events did actually happen, didn't they? Although the photographs were faked, there was.
Well, I didn't really hear that.
Well,
we were out there, so we never really heard. But all we were worried about was the photos, because none of it looked real. You wouldn't have pouches undone. You never have a rifle without a sling. But yeah, the damage is done, whether it happened or not. They would say it would be a cover up by the British government if found unproven. Yes, it felt far more dangerous. But I'm not sure. A lot of this was purely just because we were getting the intelligence briefs of literally how many IEDs had gone off that day. Which, if I hadn't have got those, I wouldn't have known there'd been bomb blasts in town. We could hear them from the airport, but there was constant gunfire and rounds going off. So
you were really aware all the time?
Yes, but because I was passing this information on to the blokes, and usually whatever happened in Baghdad, we'd get the same tactics 3 or 4 days later.
Mm.
And the tactics were sort of very, very clever. They'd have daisy chain IEDs, so they'd have them lying in wait for when the medics arrived, and you know, it got very... very nasty. And while we were there, I think that 3 police stations got hit in one day. And I think, again, I think one of the vehicle, I think those are suicide bombers, one hit the front gate and another hit the front gate about half an hour later when, you know, obviously all the medics and all the police were there, so caused a lot more casualties. So they were getting very clever about it. And that must have been the first of the suicide attacks. That's a bit of alarming. And I think as we were leaving, the British were pulling. I think now they have pulled back. They've sort of got rid of the Ba'ath Party headquarters, I believe, isn't there anymore. And they're drawing back into the airfield because it's outside town. That's sort of big open desert around it, so it's easier to protect.
I suppose you're aware of the complexity of, you know, this question, should we draw the troops out or keep them there, you know?
Again, there's no easy answer. In the Arabic mindset, that would be losing face if you draw the troops out, and they would claim that as a victory. So it's, you know, what do you do? That's a tough one. But yes, it was very odd the first few days, very aware that I'm in uniform and that I am an invading army. And you can't help but think, well, if I was sitting in London and Iraqi troops went up and down my street with their weapons sticking out of a vehicle, what would I feel? So it was very strange. Yes, still haven't come up with an answer. So.
Yes, the fact that you were there in more peaceful, well, you know, it was in the war. But so far as the civilians were concerned, yes.
And it's obviously continually changed. The war phase felt so different from this stage. Two are quite separate to me.
Yeah. Did the your men, or you as well, did you ever talk about the anti-war movement at home, not only in this country but in Europe as well? You know, did that affect morale or performance, do you think?
No, no. No, it's never discussed. I don't think we're really aware of it. Yes, it'd be scoffed at if it was on the if it was on the sort of 2 week out of date newspapers that we get, but no, I wasn't really aware of it. I was aware of some of the marches. That must have happened in between coming back from Iraq the first time, and or maybe even pre-war. I can't quite remember. So.
Yes, I suppose the big one would have been February, wouldn't it, pre-war?
Okay, yes, but obviously because I didn't know I was going, it didn't really mean much to me. And to me, the whole war just felt like it was inevitable. It felt like unfinished business from 91. That wasn't quite completed, and this was going to go on.
Were you there when any VIPs visited? I know Tony Blair came, didn't
he? Yeah, we had Prince of Wales came over. One of my guys in my section used to work for his archive. And knows Kevin quite well, and obviously went to meet him that night. And yeah, there was always VIPs. It was never known until he rocks up. I was in Basra Palace when his helicopter landed, and I can't remember, we were just wandering around, and he walked past us. And it was interesting, his entourage, someone was carrying a cushion, which had a obviously a nice cushion for him to sit on, and someone else was carrying several different uniforms, because obviously he's commander-in-chief of the parachute regiment, so at the palace he was seeing the parachute regiment, so he had his red maroon beret on. Came somewhere else, he had a different beret on. It was quite interesting, literally changing uniforms as he went. And we knew the close protection team that were his bodyguards. We had escorted them. Ironically, we were escorting the close protection team a few times when the GEC, the GOC, General Officer Commanding, so the guy in charge of British forces in Iraq, sometimes we'd take him out and about. In fact, that was one of our hairiest days, just towards the end of the tour. He was flying up to Nasiriyah to an airfield, and we were driving with the close protection team. First we had to go to Basra Palace, and then we had to go back through town, and I was map reading and commander of this escort, and some roads were blocked, and we got pumped into this wrong bit of town that was out of bounds to us, but we couldn't get out of it, so we had to go down it. And you look for things that are going to imply trouble, no people on the streets, or there'd been a road traffic accident just in front of us, which I thought could have been a decoy or a bluff, and the street we almost had to go down to avoid this was empty, and there was a fire halfway down, so it was all obscured by smoke, and it was like, okay lads, weapons ready, this doesn't look right. So we just went hell for leather, burnt down this road. I think there was some crackle of gunfire, but we never really noticed it. And I think further out towards Nasiriyah we got several bursts of machine gun fire, but no, I've got a radio in one ear and the vehicle noise in the other ear. The top cover guy has the wind in both ears and the radio, so all you can hear is like brrr, brrr, brrr. You just, is anyone hit? No, let's carry on. So it's quite scary.